From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the roots of today's right wing in Texas, historians trace them back to secession, white supremacy, and McCarthyism.
McCarthy wasn't quite tough enough for some Texans, that he was considered a little too nuanced, a little too reasoned in his witch hunt, that some of the Texans he encountered were calling for the death penalty, where he was just content to ruin people's lives.
And Texas progressives launch another effort to expand Medicaid across the state. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The winning ways of the right wing in Texas just have to be admired. Since 1994, the Republican Party have shut out Democrats from any statewide office. And 1976 was the last time that a Democrat presidential candidate won the state. That was Jimmy Carter. This is a streak of victories that any political party would envy and dream to duplicate, and it is certainly one that is worthy of dissection and study. But the successes of the right wing in Texas go back much farther than 1994. That's according to the new book, The Texas Right, The Radical Roots of Lone Star Conservatism, published by Texas A&M University Press. The book is a compilation of essays exploring the origins of Texas right-wing ideas, rhetoric, and practices that precede the Reagan Revolution, FDR's New Deal, and even the Civil War, and remain present in the current election cycle. The authors find that the concerns of the right weren't locked into party labels, and for much of that timeline, the proponents of the right agenda were in the Democratic Party. They then began converting to Republicans after the civil rights reforms of President Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s, and that conversion continued with Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign in 1980, and finally, George W. Bush's gubernatorial victory over Ann Richards in 1994. The book's authors find that the right-wing actors in the Texas political theater frequently resorted to eliminationism to root out progressive movements, using strong-arm tactics of shutting down liberal newspapers, voter intimidation, anti-voter laws, segregation, and lynchings to vanish competing concepts. Kyle G. Wilkinson is the co-editor of The Texas Right and is a professor of history at Collin College.
David Klein used that term in the introduction, which is, you know, it grabbed your attention. It's a pretty strong phrase, but frequently that has been the case, that the cultural roots of political discourse in Texas have not been terribly pluralistic. If you go all the way back to the period just before the Civil War, when communities were hanging people they suspected of being abolitionists, there was very little sense of there being a loyal opposition. You know, you're either with us or you're against us.
Right, and that's during the Texas Troubles.
Right, correct.
And that was the right. Era that led up to secession.
That's correct.
Where we basically had mob rule in Texas.
Absolutely. And so, you know, there's all kinds of deeper roots that I'm sure that we could have tried to trace out the impact of sort of frontier experience on development of a people's culture. Certainly, enforcing slavery and later enforcing white supremacy. Frequently, the culture resorted to extra-legal eliminationism. So I think that that's probably something that deserves more attention. I think we've tended to, when it comes to racial violence, for example, I think we've tended to sort of isolate that out as a discrete phenomenon, when it may indeed tell us something about the larger mainstream culture, including political culture in Texas. But it's not unique. You know, Texas is not, in spite of our best wishes, to the contrary, Texas is not really a world unto itself. It's part of the American South.
Eliminationism, not an actual policy, but it is a tendency of the radical right, as described in the book, to pursue the outright elimination of opposing sides through suppression, removal, extermination, frequently through extra-legal, outside-of-the-law type tactics with things like the Ku Klux Klan, lynching, and voter intimidation at the barrel of a gun.
Eliminationism is, whatever its roots are, I would think that most of the authors in this volume would see it as pretty much a fringe tendency, that the triumph of the right was because their message resonated with a broad spectrum of the culture. I don't think we argue in the book that the triumph of the Texas right is due to eliminationism. That is one feature that has recurred,
But it's been very successful. I mean, whenever there was a challenge to this philosophy that emphasized liberty over equality and economic individualism over community interest, things like the Progressive Party or even to Texas Socialist Party or Raza Unida or any other kind of groups in Texas that would try and challenge that, we had newspapers shut down, even the hippie movements of Austin in the 1960s and 70s, harsh intimidation tactics from the Austin PD, driving a lot of these people out of Texas, harsh drug laws, doing the same thing.
Sure, and you could even argue mandatory sentencing might fit into that category as well, and the plethora of felony convictions that remove people from the voter list. Once again, I think that there's two different sides to this. One is the repression of opposition, but the other, and I think most of the writers in this volume focused on the other side of the coin, is what was the appeal? What were the roots of this strongly conservative tendency in Texas politics? And we try to show that it had a broad appeal that was rooted pretty deeply in Texas culture.
The book points out that a lot of that was driven by post-Civil War white supremacism.
Sure, absolutely. The cultural thread that gets pulled out, teased out, and used as sort of a raw meat or red meat or whatever we want to call it, isn't fixed. And when white supremacy safely in the mainstream, public expressions of white supremacy were safely in the mainstream of Texas culture, then absolutely, they use that. But when that ceases to be the case, then there are any number of things that can fill in for that. Fear of the other, invasion by unlawful immigrants, homosexuality, abortion. So the hot button changes, but the reliance upon it doesn't. That's one of the things I tried to point out in my chapter on Lemons, W.F. Lemons, is that he provides a pretty functional template that, while the specifics change, you don't hear people that follow him so openly using the kind of racist, misogynistic language that he did, but the moving parts work together about the same regardless of what you fill them in with.
And the state legislature in 1923 prohibited African Americans from even voting in Democratic primaries. And if you couldn't win a Democratic primary, I mean, that's all there really was. There was no Republican Party. And
right.
And this had been challenged by the Supreme Court, and then the Texas legislature would make adaptations to that and continue to find ways to prevent African Americans from actually voting in primaries, the white primary system that we had in Texas, even going to the point where they defined the Democratic Party as a voluntary organization with the right to freely choose its membership and qualifications without reference to state law.
Right, sure, right. Yes.
And that went on until 1944.
Correct.
So that was how could you there was a racial test. And this is before, and then we had the poll tax and intelligence test and these other things that were installed in the Texas election code to weed out undesirables to vote.
The poll tax is very interesting to me because it was sold openly in 1902 by its sponsors. It had to be voted on by the people. In 1902, they were urged by their political leadership to go out and vote for it as a white supremacy measure. This was openly touted as a means of protecting the white privilege. But the not-so-unforeseen side effect of that was that it eliminated a huge swath of poor whites as well. They claim to be going after black voters, and they certainly did eliminate them for the very good reason that most African-American voters, potential voters, were sharecroppers who operated in a cashless vacuum. So any money, any cash money required to be paid for something just eliminates them completely. But it also eliminated probably as much as a third or even more of the white voters. Here are the facts that in passing the poll tax, voter participation in the following elections were cut about in half. So you eliminate half the voters claiming to be going after 12%, the black vote. And I think that is another example of what you're talking about, because afterwards, and I don't know that anyone's really examined this as closely as we should, and this book here certainly just in his introduction, David points out that this is an opening of what we hope is a continuing scholarly conversation on this, more research. But going back to the poll tax, the point I was about to make is that if you eliminate half the voter list, then you're left basically with only the top economic half participating, then imagine what a dramatic change that makes in the political culture of the state of Texas.
And you point out in the book that this, of course, was to the benefit of the elite of Texas.
Oh, sure. It makes it much more, the electorate becomes a lot more manageable. They simply don't, talking about eliminationism, I mean, they don't even have to speak to the issues or needs. The bottom half simply disappears. They're not part of the polity anymore and don't have to be consulted.
So how does this connect to the right wing? And let's go ahead and get into the point where we have to define our terms, because it's very difficult, because not too distant past, the right wing was pretty much a big part of the Democratic Party in Texas.
Sure. Partisan labels are pretty fluid. Ideology is something that's, you know, more easily defined. And, of course, definition is the game. But we struggled with that. Ultimately, David and I decided to as much as possible, leave that definition up to each individual author about what the right wing is. The truth of the matter is that, you know, compared to a lot of places, the Texas center would be probably the right wing elsewhere. So the Texas right wing frequently was not a fringe operation. It may look like the right wing to observers or scholars, but frequently it had a huge impact on the actual governance, the actual policy making in the state of Texas. So, but what is the right? You know, we don't attempt to be definitive in this book. I think we ask each author to address that in early on in their chapter, to tell us how they define it. But essentially, the consensus would be that it's conservatism that is running on a little leaner mixture of fuel, I suppose. You know, that it's not simply seeking to preserve the status quo, but it is perhaps characterized by a sense of alarm that about the possibility of change, the damage that they believe that the passage of time and change can do to Texas society, and a desire to stop it, to stop that change.
And that change can be, as Texas sees, a changing demographics in the state. There are several places in the book where you draw a direct line between some of these past right-wing phases that we've seen in Texas past, like the Southern Committee to Uphold the Constitution, mm-hmm. Embracing Joe McCarthy or the Red Scare in Texas, the John Birch Society, Dixiecrats. All of those things are a line that lead right to the Texas Tea Party that we see today.
I think some of the authors would argue that. It depends on the individual chapter, but certainly Texas has had a stronger dose of that line within the conservative movement than most places. I think it's George Green who points out that McCarthy wasn't quite tough enough for some Texans, that he was considered a little too nuanced, a little too reasoned in his witch hunt, that some of the Texans he encountered were calling for the death penalty where he was just content to ruin people's lives. Yes, absolutely. But whether or not it's the Tea Party probably deserves further investigation. I feel a little reticence about going that close to the present, but as an observer, as someone who watches the news and reads the papers and tries to keep informed, it seems to me that the Texas Tea Party certainly appears to be the latest manifestation in this tradition.
And the continuation of the eliminationism here today, the book points out, it's still here. And looking at things in the past, during Election Day in 1896, 40 Democrats in Robertson County held rifles while surrounding the courthouse to block the entrance. The county judge later wrote, "I went down to the polls, took my six-shooter, stayed there until the polls closed. Not a Negro voted." And they talk about the eliminationism continuing with voter ID today.
Yes, I'm comfortable talking about voter elimination. I do see connection there. I think some of the authors might be more comfortable in talking about eliminationism in a more dire way, but it does seem to me clearly that if we're talking about elimination of participation in the polity, that has been a recurring theme on the Texas right. That if you can't, there are right voters or correct voters, the right people voting, and then there are the wrong people voting. And if we could just eliminate the wrong people from voting, then you get the polity that you need. And it comes from, I think, another word that would describe that as an absolute certainty, the righteousness of their cause.
And this idea of conditional whiteness, this whole hierarchy that was set up in Texas based upon your whiteness. And if you were black, of course, you weren't white. But if you were Mexican, or even if you were from the wrong parts of Europe or any other part of the world other than
Jewish. Jewish.
And so they actually issued health cards in Dallas, which identified your whiteness.
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing. And I think that the part that I would emphasize, that's Michael Phillips' chapter on sort of conditional whiteness, but the part that I would emphasize in looking at that is the issue of class, and it's something that we don't talk about in Texas culture. All whites are middle class now, but at that time, the elites were redefining, as Michael puts it, that white also had to do with your politics, your reliability at the ballot box, and from the 1890s on, from the populist rebellion, they discovered that there were whites, that there were people whose skin were white, who didn't vote white, who didn't vote for the Democratic Party, who didn't vote for conservatism, and they began to doubt their fitness to be in the club, so to speak. And this was a conundrum, a real puzzle for the elites to deal with, because for 300 years they had preached in Southern culture, ignore class, pay attention only to color. Color is the only thing that matters. Poor whites and rich whites, we got to have an inter-class coalition to operate white supremacy and slavery.
Speaking with Professor Kyle G. Wilkinson, he is a co-editor of The Texas Right, The Radical Roots of Lone Star Conservatism. And as we talk about this conditional whiteness, it's clear that any whiteness that could be granted by the elites could also be whiteness lost. And this was a lever that was used to manipulate marginal whites to have a powerful incentive to support anti-black segregation.
Absolutely, and in the process of doing that, of thinking that's what they were doing, of supporting anti-black segregation, many of these poor whites also went out and eagerly voted themselves out of the right to vote.
And also installed the right to work of Texas, which undermined their own best interest.
It certainly kept them from being able to effectively form labor unions, and that's another, I think, a key element of trying to understand Texas mass culture as it relates to politics, is that unions were successfully portrayed to poor majority as their enemy, that unions somehow were going to prevent them from successfully negotiating man-to-man with their employer, that it was a foreign, outside, third party that had no interest, that no true business being in the mix. It was just there to take dues from you. The unions were Yankee outsiders, often foreign-led with socialist ties. And this was all, I think, wonderfully effective, especially because for most of our history, the poor majority in Texas in the urban working class have been first or second generation rural people, that they're from the land and they come from a rural culture with no connection to labor unions, and it was, and but with deep misgivings, even hostility toward Northerners and outsiders, and also the issue of class consciousness is very complicated for poor rural people, because throughout Southern history, frequently the people that I call the plain folks or the ordinary run-of-the-mill rural white Southerner might have blood ties to people that would be effectively, in terms of economics, members of the elite. And this these community relationships, third cousins or in-laws or face-to-face relationships between well-off white Southerners and more run-of-the-mill white Southerners, or even people who are objectively poor, basically kept class formation from occurring in terms of the Southern working class, that they tended to see their boss, when they left the countryside and went to Dallas or Houston and went to work in a factory, that they saw their employer not as a member of a competing class that did not have their best interests at heart, but simply as Joe, the individual guy who, in their world, could very well have been a cousin, and they consider themselves to be equals. But they were not, in any kind of objective, measurable way, the equals of the owners who employed them. But as long as they believe themselves to be, this is going to keep them from engaging in anything like collective bargaining.
Right, and this is called in the book a false consciousness. The working class voters fail to recognize what their own best interests are and continue to relate and identify with the elites and continue to support them even at their own cost.
That term, false consciousness, is extremely loaded within the historical community. It is fraught with all kinds of baggage, and there are fierce debates on that about whether or not these people can be said to have false consciousness. One side says that it may simply be the case that their cultural precepts, their cultural values, outweigh economic self-interest in their calculations. And if that is true, then they're just simply fulfilling the living up to the values of their culture and cannot be said to be suffering from false consciousness. While the other camp would argue that if they're engaging behavior that results in their economic harm without realizing it, then that is, by definition, an act of false or a manifestation of false consciousness. So we should acknowledge that is something of a highly contested term within the history business.
So here we are today, getting ready to have early voting pretty soon here in Texas in the primary. We know that that's when the right manages to hang on to their rule in the state. Do you see echoes in some of the rhetoric that we hear from our politicians, particularly in, say, like the lieutenant governor's race for the GOP nomination, people may not realize it, but things that they're saying, they've been said before and before and before for the last 150 years.
Yeah, what I see is appeals to a very robust masculinity that is rooted in kind of a cowboy, thus white, cultural heritage, toughness, and also of concerns about the other, about staving off a potential invasion, in this case of undocumented immigrants. You could draw lines all the way back to that critical period of the Texas Troubles if you were seeking the roots of that.
Kyle G. Wilkerson is a professor of history at Collin College and is the co-editor of the book The Texas Right, The Radical Roots of Lone Star Conservatism. David O'Donnell Collin is the other co-editor. The book is a follow-up to their previous book, The Texas Left, The Radical Roots of Lone Star Liberalism. Both are published by Texas A&M Press. Texas Left Me Out. That's the name of a new campaign launched this week by progressive groups in Texas trying to build political pressure on the Texas legislature to expand Medicaid in the state through the Affordable Care Act. The campaign will highlight that Texans who could benefit from getting health coverage had the expansion been approved by Austin, but they are now left in the coverage gap. Tiffany Hoag is a healthcare campaign director for the Texas Organizing Project.
The Texas Left Me Out launch is really about a continuation of what many organizations have worked very hard to put together over the past year and a half or so. And it's really organizations that really want to see how we're expanding health coverage in the state of Texas. We currently, because of decisions made in the state legislature in last year, Texas chose to deny and reject $100 billion that would have expanded coverage for over a million Texans. And because we rejected that money, now we have a situation where over a million Texans are literally being left without access to affordable health care because they don't make quite enough money to go into the Affordable Care Act exchange to get financial aid. So we do have a strange situation where there's a coverage gap and Texans that are lowest income to moderate income do not have access or a way of getting affordable health care.
What are y'all trying to do? Texas Left Me Out. Is this a political campaign? You're not able to provide these people, these uninsured people, with insurance because Texas didn't expand Medicaid, so there's nothing you can do for them.
Well, no, there's always something. The next legislative session is coming. This decision was made in Texas, and it can be changed in Texas. And it doesn't even need to wait until the next legislative session. At any time, the governor can choose to negotiate with the federal government to figure out how they draw down the money. And states like Arizona, Arkansas, Kentucky, that are not known for their liberal leanings, have figured out a way to make this part of the Affordable Care Act work for their state. So whatever that Texas solution is to expand coverage can happen at any time, and that's what we're pushing for.
The people who are opposed to Medicaid expansion, they say that Texas Medicaid patients already have the worst access to medical specialists, and we have a low reimbursement rate, and that has led to specialists not accepting Medicaid patients. So they say, why put more people in Medicaid when it's not a great system?
The Medicaid program is a combination of a state and a federal program. But every single state operates and manages their Medicaid program in a different way. So, I mean, the things that you just mentioned, reimbursement rate, the network, that is controlled by Austin. That is not controlled by the federal government. Our reimbursement rates can absolutely be changed in Austin.
Tiffany Hoag is the healthcare campaign director for the Texas Organizing Project. They've joined with 40 other healthcare advocacy organizations and faith and community groups to push for the expansion of Medicaid in the state of Texas under the Affordable Care Act. There's more information on their website at texasleftmeout.org. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to Texas Matters with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also comment directly on our show page at tpr.org, and that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. We're also available on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.